So we are continuing and actually completing our study in Esther this evening. And so we're going to do a little bit of overview or review, but really focus on the end of chapter 9, or chapter 9 and chapter 10. And it may seem like a, you know, impossible task for me to get through two chapters, but chapter 10 is only three verses, so I have that working in my favor. One thing we looked at in the overall review or overall study of this book is the idea that God's not specifically mentioned in this book. He's not named in this book, and that made some people think that that means it shouldn't be part of the scriptures, that it was just written by someone else and didn't deserve its place in the scriptures. But others use that information, that knowledge, to understand that God didn't need to be named specifically throughout the book of Esther, because it was more the idea that God was taking care of his people, taking care of Esther, and doing it through providential means. And that will be an interesting or an important thing to remember for the Jews as they are going to be released from captivity and going back to Jerusalem. And there will be the period of time between the Testaments, that 400 years, where they aren't receiving messages from God. And so it seems like it may be just a way to prepare them for what they're going to be experiencing, and showing that God's still there, God is still taking care of them throughout that time, even though it's not in the direct communication like they had before, and the performing of those miracles by the prophets and so forth. So as we look at this book then, as we're in a period of time where we're no longer receiving direct communication from God, we have the scriptures that provide all the information that we need. But we can look at Esther in the same way and see that we may not understand why the things are happening that happen in our lives, whether it's to us as individuals or to Christians in general, or just events in the world around the nations. We can know that God cares and God is going to take care of us. And that was one of the main themes we recently or a while ago studied in Daniel, that God works in the affairs of men. God is in control, and he may allow things to happen that are unpleasant and in some cases evil, where perhaps he's using evil nation to punish another evil nation. He may allow those things to occur. He's not the one performing any evil acts, of course. But we can know that God's taking care, God's wisdom is greater than our wisdom. God knows what's best for us and what will benefit us the most in the long term in our lives. And so we can trust him. And this, Esther is an example of just an episode where God did just that. And so if we can look at this and see, here's one example of where God provided for his people and took care of them and gave them exactly what they needed, how many more episodes and how many more stories of these kind of things are not recorded that have occurred throughout history? And we can have those things in our lives as well. So as we look in Esther 9, we're going to do a quick review of chapter 9, verses 1 through 19, and then we'll start with the new material in verse 20. And I just kind of copied and pasted highlights of each of the main things that happened in there. So I'm just going to read through this, and it will it won't match up exactly with what your Bibles have, because I skipped a few things. But in Esther 9, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. So we'll stop there for just a second and remember how it was that these enemies of the Jews were going to gain mastery over them. And that was because of Haman's hatred for Mordecai. Haman hated Mordecai because Mordecai would not honor him in the way that he wanted to be honored and didn't treat him with the high regard that he felt that he deserved. And so Haman, not only did Haman want to punish Mordecai for those transgressions, but he wanted to annihilate the Jews as a whole. And so he was able to pretty easily convince the king to sign a decree so that he could get rid of some bothersome people in his kingdom. And he didn't really clarify who it was and what all was involved. But the king, who pretty much went along with whatever people suggested to him, he signed off on it. And so he, Haman got the go-ahead. But when Mordecai and Esther found out what was involved in that decree, Esther brought it before the king, and the king condemned Haman's actions, and Haman just made things worse by appearing to be trying to then assault the queen. So the king had no patience with that, and so he was killed. And the decree, however, could not be reversed because of the Persian law, so it remained in place. And they had spent time trying to figure out when is the opportune time for us to destroy this nation of the Jews. What is the best month and day when we can exact this this murder? And so they had cast lots, and eventually it came down to quite a bit of time had passed between when the decree had gone out and when they actually were going to carry it out. So there was time for the Jews and time for Haman and Esther to come to the nation's rescue. And Esther was needed to be prompted a little bit to take courage and to do her part to be a blessing to the nation in the way that she could. But eventually they figured out a way. And so with Haman out of the picture, Mordecai was raised to second in command over the nation, over the kingdom. And so he had power and authority in his own right. But he returned to Esther to try to get her to get the king's authority, to get the king to certify it so that it would be accepted throughout the kingdom. And when she did that, his response was, I already gave you my signet ring. You do whatever you want. I'll sign off on anything. Consider it done, which kind of tells you how seriously he took the authority that he was given. So it was a dangerous situation for him to be in power and be so easily manipulated. But Mordecai and Esther determined that they could create their own decree that would not reverse the original decree that the Jews could be slaughtered, but it would counter it. It would give the Jews recourse, give them opportunity for self-defense, and we're going to see a little bit about that as well as we go forward. So this is looking at the day that had been figured out to be the best day for this to happen. Well, it turns out the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on the people. All of the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews for fear of Mordecai. So we see the political machinery pivoted from Haman and wanting to do what he, his ideas to carry out, and saw that, oh, Mordecai has the power now. We better, get behind him and make sure that we're on the right side of this, not morally, but politically. And so they backed Mordecai and they helped the Jews to avoid that destruction. So we see Mordecai, they have the fear of Mordecai. I don't know if there was something that Mordecai did to instill that fear, or if it was just that's how they were used to being governed, where whoever was in charge, whoever had power, you know, obviously if you wronged Haman, then he wouldn't just take it out on you, he'd take it out on your whole nation. And so I could see where that fear was just standard practice for them, to fear the one who had more power, who had power that could result in their destruction. And so Mordecai grew more and more powerful, and the Jews struck all their enemies with the sword. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed the 10 sons of Haman. They laid no hand to on the plunder, and on the second day, which Queen Esther had petitioned the king for, she asked that they have a second day where they could carry out this as well in Susa specifically. And so it appears that Susa had been a stronghold for Haman, that there was enough people that were still backing him and were against the Jews, that the job wasn't finished and it needed to be continued to make the Jews safe. So on that second day, they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hand on the plunder. The rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but laid no hands on the plunder. So 75,000 is a lot of people, but this is over 127 provinces. It says from India to Ethiopia. And so it seems to be a measured response. And it's not just an act of vengeance, it's an act of justice. It's an act where they were killing and destroying these people that were actively and aggressively trying to kill them. And so it was an act basically of self-defense for their nation. And we see that the decree and I forgot to write down the verse number on this, but the decree that was given by Mordecai was basically the same type of decree that was given by Haman, that they could kill men, women, and children, that they could take the spoils and the plunder and make themselves rich. And it's speculated that that's how Haman planned on paying for the 40,000 or the price that he paid the king to be able to wage this war, that he was going to be gathering the spoils of the Jews and using it for that. But the Jews were then given the ability to, you know, blank check to be able to go out and wage war against these people, kill men, women, and children, take all the, you know, plunder they wanted. But when we read that, the accounting of it and what the Jews actually did, it was a very, like I said, a measured response as far as the killing. And it specifies, in at least in the accounts like in Susa, and I think it would follow through for the 75,000 throughout the territories, that they didn't kill the women and children, that they killed men, as it's specified there. So they weren't engaging in the kind of violent and terrible warfare that was going to be perpetrated upon them. Rather, they were fighting a righteous war of defense for the nation. So we see, we want to just consider then that difference, what they did and did not do. So they had the opportunity, politically or from the government, they had the authority to destroy men, women, children, and take all the plunder, but they were acting at a higher level. They were acting, answering to a higher responsibility, and did not take advantage of the nation or of the Persians in that way, of their enemies. So this was an act of justice versus just an act of revenge, an act of anger and hatred, like would have been carried out against them. So throughout that turn of events, we see God saves his people. He will preserve his people, even in ways that we don't understand and would least expect. God can figure out how to make good come from evil. And so that's really the main idea of this lesson, is that God has the ability, God has the wisdom, he has the power to make good come from evil. And he has the knowledge to know what true good is and what is evil. And so we need to trust him to be able to take care of us and provide for us in that way. So that catches us up to verse 20. So we'll pick up reading there. Excuse me. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month of Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year. So those were the days that had been determined as, you know, the 14th was the day that Haman and his people had picked as the day to have revenge or to destroy the Jews. And that turned into the day that the Jews gained mastery over those who hated them, their enemies. And then the 15th was the additional day that Esther had petitioned for in Susa. And so they took these days, and Mordecai obliging them to keep the 14th day and of the month, Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned from them for them, from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another, and gifts to the poor. So we see this is referred to in the Jewish culture as the Feast of Purim, and I think it actually uses that term later on. And this is the establishment of that holiday, those 2 days. And it basically just shows the way that God took this terrible day that could have been a day of, you know, the worst day in generations for the Jews. Could have been the darkest day they'd ever experienced. And God took it and turned it into a celebration and a day of feasting and giving gifts and happiness and joy. And so we can see that God has that ability. Just as he can provide for us, he can turn evil to good. He can turn sorrow into gladness and joy. And probably the greatest example, or the greatest example of this, is in Jesus' crucifixion, where the greatest good that ever happened came from the greatest evil that ever happened. The payment for mankind's sins from the beginning of mankind to the end of mankind was made on that day, and making it possible for mankind to enter back into a relationship with God and to be one with God. And that was all done by the worst thing that had ever happened on this earth, and that was the destroying of, or the crucifixion of our Creator. The Creator coming down and suffering at the hands of his creation, suffering physically, you know, pain and agony that he went through, but also suffering just the insults and treatment by the Jews and Romans as well. He endured that so that we could have that relationship with God. So he took something that was just the worst experience, the worst evil in the world, and turned it into the greatest good. So we see God has the power to do that, and we just have to be able to trust him that he will do that in our lives as well. So in continuing in 23, so the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast cast lots to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they call these days Purim, after the term pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and what of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them. So we see this is the installation of this holiday, describing what it was that the purpose of it and the origin, how God perhaps had controlled those lots that were cast. Haman and his men would think that their gods or some other entity were controlling those lots that were being cast, but perhaps God was even in controlling that and saying, here's how much time I want for my people to prepare for this. Here's the day and month where I'm going to bring them out of this threat. And as they take that name of, it was casting lots, and use that in the name for their holiday, it's like they're taking ownership of that threat that was made against them. That they're taking it as their own and saying, we survived this because of God. So we're going to name it after this so that we don't forget. Because, and some will, some authors or commentaries and so forth say that after a while the celebration of Purim just turned into drunkenness and gift giving, and really they had forgotten the whole reason that they were celebrating. But I think the idea of naming it that way was hopefully that they wouldn't forget, that it would be a reminder to them where how God took care of them and overcame. So they claim that day for themselves. And we've had some experience with that. There's like 9/11. 9/11 is not just a day where everybody mourns and weeps and remembers those who were lost. They may do those things, but we also celebrate our resilience and celebrate the lives of those who showed such bravery and courage in fighting, to get as many people as they could to safety, were willing to sacrifice in any way that they could. And so we claim that day, and we've taken it back so that it's not just a negative day in our history, but one that showed the resolve of our nation and the strength. Just like also Patriots Day, the day of the Boston Marathon bombing, they've taken that day back to celebrate the people and not just have it be a negative event, a negative memory that they have to suffer through. So Haman, and we talked about Haman, how he was hung on his own gallows, how his hatred just destroyed himself. And there's been a few Star Wars slides that have been coming through here. I was going to, just looking at how I could use your hatred will destroy you and so forth. And Star Wars has a few good lessons, and that's one of them. That hatred, your hatred will destroy you. You may also destroy others in the process, and so that's also bad. But your hatred will never overcome the perceived wrongs that were done against you. It'll only make things worse. And so for Haman, that's exactly what happened. As I was reading it, him being hung on his own gallows, I was thinking of there's a phrase, hoist with one's own petard. And we don't use that, most of that petard, I don't think most people know what that is. But it comes from a petard is an explosive. So it's just like a bomb that they would take and run up to the doors of the castle or whatever and try to set it up there so that it would explode and people could get in. It's most famous from Shakespeare's Hamlet, where he says, "For 'tis the sport to have this engineer hoist with his own petard." So he's kind of making fun of the engineers that they get all their explosives in the box and run up there and, you know, go to light it, and they end up being tossed in the air and blown away by their own explosives. We've had some close experiences with that on our 4th of July parties. Fortunately, nothing too serious. But the idea is just being victimized or hurt by one's own scheme. And that is exactly Haman. He was angry and hateful and wanted, I guess, extreme vengeance, way beyond what, you know, he would deserve for someone not honoring him the way that he wanted to. And so he thought up all these ways of doing it, and then he ended up being hoisted by his own petard. So it's a lesson for us to be careful and mindful of what we, or how we respond to slights against us, wrongs against us, that we don't, well, hopefully, we don't let it get anywhere near that far. Hopefully, we are forgiving and understanding of people and can let it go and not have it affect us. But even when it does kind of get under our skin for a while, we need to be mindful and watchful of not letting that get out of control and being able to rein it in and deal with it properly. So as we continue, they... I believe it was, 27. The Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year. That these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. And so the Jews, they really bought in to this observance. They dedicated themselves to this holiday and commemorating God's providence and deliverance. There we, in 29, it continues, then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew, gave full written authority confirming this letter, this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to 127 provinces in the kingdom of Ahasuerus, in the words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at the appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. So we see that it's not just something that they're going to kind of let them police themselves on, or hopefully they'll remember this. Esther and Mordecai communicate to the Jews throughout the kingdom that they're all going to observe this together. And really, that is something that solidifies their unity. They had been in exile and spread out through these different provinces, and so it would be very easy for them to be separated, disjointed, no longer be aligned as a nation, and that really was the point of spreading them out over those countries and provinces, was so that they would let go of their religious practices or their political agendas and just be assimilated into the Persian culture. And this was something that was pulling everybody back together. And so when we have an opportunity, one of the things that we have is worshiping on the first day of the week. We spend the majority of our time away from each other in our own pursuits and endeavors, and don't spend as much time together as I'm sure many would like. But when we come back together to worship together, we can use that as a time to draw closer together, to encourage each other, and to draw strength from each other by sharing, you know, our challenges that we're having, or sharing in our blessings that God has given us. So they they established that, and I like how it says that Mordecai communicated in words of peace and truth. So it's one of those things where, okay, the war is over. There's not going to be any more carried on violence toward people. We need to be peaceful. We need to be honorable in the kingdom that we're in, the system that under which we're living. And we need to be operating in truth. And that's just, identifying God's word and living by the standards that the Lord has given us. So we get to chapter 10. It says, King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? So we're going to stop there for a second. So it kind of harkens back to the first chapter, where it just is describing King Ahasuerus and his great wealth. The taxes had been ceased for a while once he was marrying Queen Esther, as kind of a celebration for everybody to have some benefit from. And so now things are getting back to normal. Things are going back to the way they were. Taxes are getting started again. The king's got another second in command that he probably, trusts completely and will approve whatever he suggests. It's interesting, and I think it's important that it's put in there, that the acts were recorded in the books of Chronicles of the Kings of Media and Persia. So the Jews, as they were going out, coming out of exile and going back to Jerusalem, they would be able to look back and see these events that happened. They would have the Book of Esther that they would be able to read and see what happened there. But then they would also get the confirmation that even the Persians in their history books recognize what happened in this situation, how God provided for the people and preserved them. And then finally in verse 3, for Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. So this is the kind of the best case scenario for a faithful person that is getting into politics, that they can operate the way they need to operate, being truthful and honest and fair, and that those people around them will appreciate what they're doing. And so Mordecai, as he was doing what he was supposed to be doing, people saw that. They saw that they didn't need to be afraid for their lives like they would have been with Haman, but that he could be trusted to do what was right, to do the honorable thing. And so he grew in strength and power. So, like I said with Daniel, one of the themes was God rules in the kingdoms of men. So Esther, that is one of the primary themes. And then, as it was written about the events that occurred while in exile, the purpose appears to be to encourage the Jews during the times of persecution that they were going to face, and also for the period of silence between the testaments that they would be enduring. Because I'm sure that would be a disturbing change for them to no longer have any active prophets and not have access to the voice of God like they had in the past. So as we close up here, the want to go back to that scripture reading in Romans chapter 8 and verse 26. We'll just start in 28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. So a lot of times, the verse is truncated to say all things work out for good. Sometimes people add on, for those that love the Lord. And that makes it so it's a broad, of course I love God. Who wouldn't love God? So things should work out for good for me. But then the last part of it is, and are called according to his purpose. So we have to make sure that we are listening to God's purposes for us, that we're following his will. And when we do that, this doesn't mean that we're never going to suffer in this life. That we're never going to get sick or have loved ones that get sick or suffer persecutions. The New Testament is full of warnings to be prepared for persecutions because they will come. But when we're called according to God's purpose, we can overcome those things because God is going to preserve us. And we won't go into too much of it, but as is the other remaining verses, 29 and 30, talk about those who were chosen or predestined to conform to his image. And that kind of reminded me of the story of Esther, where God was preserving his chosen people. He had predestined that the Christ was going to come through the Jews and David specifically, David's lineage. And so he had determined that he was going to provide for them, but they had the opportunity to not accept that provision, to rebel, and that's what happened for the majority of the Israelites in general. Israel went into captivity and was destroyed. The Jews went into captivity and only a remnant remained. And of the Jews that were then there when Christ came, it appears it was a very small percentage of those ones that were being faithful, that were really doing what they were supposed to be doing for the reasons that they were supposed to be doing it. And that's why it required John to come and preach to them and call them back to God, because they had strayed from him. So as God has predestined Christians, those who are going to be in Christ and those who will surrender their lives to Christ, he's decided he's going to save all the people that are in that group. That's the predestination that's talked about here. And so we just need to make sure that we're in that group and that we're don't just get into the group, we get baptized and become a Christian, and then we're done. It's an ongoing thing, and that's why God wants us to know that he'll provide for us and preserve us, because it's going to take effort, time, some suffering, and so we can be comfortable knowing that God's faithful to us and that we should be faithful to him. So if there's anyone who needs the prayers of the congregation, wants to talk about struggles or and how they can be more faithful, or if someone has not become a Christian, not been baptized, then we invite you to let us know and be glad to help in any way that we can as we sing the song of invitation.